From St. Mary's University of Minnesota, you're listening to St. Mary's Currents. I'm your host, Ben Rogers.
Our top story tonight, a bombshell report detailing where things went wrong for pandemic funding programs intended to help feed Minnesota children.
It's a case that stretches back more than 2 years, but finally today we get a look behind the scenes of what is being called the largest pandemic fraud in United States history.
In 2022, 47 former employees of Feeding Our Future, a Minnesota-based nonprofit, were indicted by the Department of Justice, who alleged that employees had defrauded a USDA-funded school nutrition program during the COVID-19 pandemic.
The first trial in the state's largest pandemic fraud case comes to a close, and more could be on the way.
A jury found 5 out of 7 defendants guilty of swindling more than $40 million in the Feeding Our Future fraud case.
The verdict confirms what we've known all along, which is that defendants falsified documents. They lied, and they fraudulently claimed to be feeding millions of meals to children in Minnesota during COVID.
A report from the legislative auditor last week says actions and inactions by the Department of Education opened the door for fraud in taxpayer-funded child nutrition programs.
There's not a single state employee that was implicated in doing anything that was illegal. They simply didn't do as much due diligence as they should have.
The saga of Feeding Our Future is not uncommon, according to Derek Jackson, professor in the St. Mary's School of Business and Technology. On today's episode, we discuss financial fraud, what drives people to commit fraud, why it was prevalent during the COVID-19 pandemic, and what sort of steps can be taken to combat fraud. Derek, thank you so much for joining us today. We're happy to have you on for our topic of financial fraud. But before we dive in, could you introduce yourself to our audience and let them know a bit about yourself, what you do here at St. Mary's, and what your academic interests are?
Sure. Thanks for having me today, Ben. Excited to do this. I'm Derek Jackson. I've been working at St. Mary's University of Minnesota for 13 years now. I teach accounting. I teach on the undergraduate campus full-time, and I also teach for the graduate and professional degrees once in a while online. I came from industry, so most relevant to this particular podcast is I did work as a Medicare auditor. That was my first job out of college, which is something that I was very interested in, shaped the things that I'm most interested in. I'm very interested in auditing, and auditing is a place where accountants can really flex their critical thinking muscles and problem solving. And, you know, I guess another thing I'm really passionate about is just helping people understand what accounting is, because I think accounting gets a unfair stereotype of being kind of boring and accountants just all do one thing. But there's really a lot of areas of accounting: auditing, cost, government accounting, tax. So it's really an area where there's a lot of opportunities, and I'm very passionate about letting people know about the different things that they can do in the accounting area. It's actually quite a dynamic and interesting field.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's dive in. Today we're discussing financial fraud. We thought that this would be an interesting topic in the rise of fraud we saw during COVID-19. And of course, earlier this month, a jury in Minnesota found 5 of 7 defendants guilty in the first of several federal court cases where the Department of Justice alleges the defendants defrauded a child nutrition program administered by the USDA. The organization, of course, was called Feeding Our Future, and it's since what they've named the trial in the headlines as well. This case, as well as others, have dominated headlines. With that in mind, how rampant is financial fraud in the U.S.? And while some perpetrators are being charged, like we're seeing in the Feeding Our Future cases, how much of it goes unnoticed?
Right. So, I mean, what an interesting turn that trial took with the attempted bribery there of the juror. That was crazy.
Oh, it's wild.
So it's not something you see all the time. And it was kind of a unique case as it was. So
right.
Very interesting. But look, there is an incredible amount of fraud out there in government funds and government programs, and probably more than most people want to spend their time thinking about, simply because the cases upset us. They make us mad. We see what's going on when these kind of cases come out, and it's frustrating. And if you spend a lot of time ruminating on it, it might give you a headache. In terms of dollars, if you think of the COVID funds, it's up to about $4.65 trillion that was put out into the economy by the federal government for COVID-19 pandemic relief, right? And, you know, most people can trillion, that's 12 zeros. That's a number that most people have a hard time envisioning in their minds. And a lot of the reviews that are being done now on those dollars say that, you know, they're pegging some programs are more fraud riddled, some are less, but probably 10% is a pretty good estimate of the dollars that, you know, are fraudulently being distributed for those pandemic relief dollars. So that leaves you at, you know, $465 billion of fraud inherent in that program. So, you know, it's crazy, right? It's a staggering amount of monies. And, you know, unemployment insurance was a big part of that, right? People were losing their jobs during the pandemic. Well, unemployment insurance and usually has anywhere between an 8 and a 10% rate of fraud already. During the pandemic, that number went up to about 15%, and it was 15% of a lot larger pot of money. So that was $135 billion. And if you move on from the pandemic funds, you know, where I started in the Medicare program, that's, again, a $1 trillion program annually now. And, you know, even very conservative estimates of Medicare fraud peg those dollars at 6 to 7% fraud. So now, again, you're looking at $60 to $70 billion in fraud annually in the Medicare program. So the numbers are staggering. And, you know, again, a lot of people see these cases come up. People are aware of it to some extent, but not necessarily aware of the magnitude of the dollars that are out there.
Yeah, some of those numbers are crazy.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about some positive things in a bit. But
when we were discussing this topic leading up to this recording, you were mentioning the fraud triangle, which is used to explain why people commit financial fraud. Would you explain that for our listeners?
Yeah, so the fraud triangle varies case to case, but the three components are always present. First component is the financial pressure, or some people, sometimes you'll see it drawn up as the motive or incentive. But, you know, it turns out that people like money, right? And they like money for different reasons. You know, some people are looking to get money simply because they're at a survival level of subsistence and they need money just to, you know, live from day to day. Other people are looking at living a certain lifestyle, or they've established a lifestyle that maybe it's very hard to maintain. So they're trying to push and actually sustain those lifestyle, or they've set financial goals for themselves that are hard to attain by legal means, right? So they have this financial pressure that is either real in terms of a need or has been built up psychologically as real in the sense that they need to achieve these certain goals. And this is America, right? And we're all sold the idea of the American dream. And if we work hard, we can achieve the things we want and get the things we want and have the yard and the white picket fence. And, you know, that all plays into the pressure that we put on ourselves to succeed financially in the society. The second point is rationalization. And rationalization is pretty interesting, and it leads into, you know, why government is particularly susceptible. When we talk about unethical or immoral behavior, most people don't think of themselves just as bad people. Like, they don't sit around and say, I'm a bad person. But maybe they do a bad thing or multiple bad things, but they can still rationalize that they're not immoral, that they're actually good people. And it's very hard to control rationalization because it's this internal dialogue that we have with ourselves. And in the case of government, we have to reconcile ourselves. If we're going to do something bad, if we're going to steal money, if we're going to behave badly, we have to be able to reconcile the other person or people that are affected. And that is part of the rationalization in government programs is, it's viewed by a lot of people who perpetrate government fraud as a victimless crime. Now, it's not. They're wrong in the sense that we're all affected, right? Because it's taxpayer dollars. But I don't have to walk, you know, into the dark alley and stick a gun in someone's ribs to do that, right? That's a different level of rationalization. So for government rationalization, again, we've all been sold this American dream. So a lot of people think that in a way I'm owed this and feeding our futures, right? $250 million fraud. And we all know that that is a huge amount of money. But how many taxpayers are there in the U.S.? 330 million, right? So on a per person basis, you're looking at less than a dollar. So when we get into rationalization, you know, it feels again like maybe I'm not all that bad. I'm not really a bad person, even if I do this bad thing. So rationalization is always present in frauds, but for government, maybe it becomes particularly easy to rationalize just because it's this big, heartless, faceless entity. We can't control the decisions we make. Yeah, we get to elect people, but once that's done, you know, we don't have a lot of say in what goes on. So it can be easier to rationalize those types of behaviors. And then the third leg is opportunity. So you actually need the means and some kind of in to actually achieve the fraud. So organizations spend a lot of time working on limiting opportunity because that's where you can actually have an impact. You put internal controls, they're called, in front of the system to prevent people from getting the funds to begin with, or you have controls on the back end where people are caught very quickly. And that's another way to set up internal controls in the system to limit opportunity. But again, three points on the fraud triangle are the financial pressure or the incentive motive, the rationalization, and the opportunity.
Absolutely. Well, that leans kind of into my next question. How did the COVID-19 pandemic introduce new opportunities for fraud? You know, having gone over the triangle, there's two thoughts in my mind. One, the financial pressure. As you mentioned, people lost jobs and it was a tight time for a lot of folks. And then, as you said, the U.S. government rolled out trillions of dollars to help people. So we have opportunity there.
For sure.
But as someone who has really studied this topic, what are your thoughts on what allowed new opportunities for financial fraud to flourish during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yep. So when the economy hits a rough patch, which is what happened, March of 2020, everybody, we can't go outside anymore, right? We're all stuck in our houses.
Right.
The whole dynamic changed in a very short period of time. And one of the things that's supposed to happen from an economic standpoint in our country is when private sector, when the economy hits a rough patch or there's crisis, the government is supposed to step in and inject funds into those systems in order to, you know, get things running again and make sure that people can get through the crisis situation. And that's exactly what happened. Over time, there were several waves of funds. It wasn't $4.65 trillion all at once, but there were several waves of funds that were put into different areas of the economy. And, you know, when you talk to economists at the time, you talk to economists now, you know, there's pretty good consensus that it had to happen. Without those funds, you know, we were looking at another Great Depression or certainly a very big recession, and things would have gone very badly. So, you know, you talk to some economists now and they might say, oh, well, we kind of overdid it. And since the pandemic funds, you know, since that has ended, well, that's been maybe the culprit for some of the high inflation we've seen in the last few years, right? So the trick is getting that number right. But most economists agree that it had to happen, right? So these monies needed to go out and they needed to come from the government in order to keep the economy afloat. And then the other thing that happened is we needed the money fast. Right. And the government said, we're going to inject this money into the system fast. And you don't always see government moving very fast. Right. But there was very rapid succession and, you know, bipartisan agreement to some extent that some of these things needed to happen. They needed to happen quickly, which greases the wheels and gets things through. Now, when things happen fast, back to opportunity, from the government perspective, what does that mean? That means they need to take down the barriers that are keeping the funds from flowing into the system. And those barriers tend to be the controls. So indeed, even the USDA itself had hundreds of waivers. Usually you had to do this, you know, X, Y, and Z. Well, now you only have to do X to prove that you can get the funds. And, you know, we're going to come and visit your facility every year. Well, maybe not. We're going to put a waiver on it, so we don't actually have to come and see what's going on. You know, this again In addition to the fact that just there was the $4.65 million till ultimately that existed there, right? You put your hand in there, you're going to come out with something. And then the loosening of regulations through the waivers, you know, that combination put a lot of opportunity out there. And, you know, this is opportunity for good actors, right? People who already had existing programs who said, you know what, I can do more, I can help. And people who are maybe sitting on the sidelines saying, you know what, I have an innovative way to actually help people.
Yeah.
Right. So now I can implement that because there's government funds available to do that. And that allowed them to do that. But it also, you know, ignites the devil on the shoulder of the fraudster and says, you know, here is a big opportunity in terms of size of dollars. And hey, they're taking down the barriers for me as well. So this is good opportunity in two aspects. So it's important to understand that happens, but then also important to understand to step back for a moment and say, okay, you know, everyone gets riled up. So this is bad. You look at the feeding our futures case and this is terrible, right? And we should be upset about it. But again, the good operators were able to get in there as well, right? So during these times of crisis, there are a lot of people in the government and economists and people who say, you know what, 10% fraud, 15% fraud, that's the cost of doing business, right? So you want to get those funds out there quickly. You took down the barriers. That means 85 or 90% of the dollars, which were very much needed, found their way home. So, you know, we all want to get riled up about the 10 and 15%, and we should, like, right? It's not good. It's money taken from the system. But on the flip side, we needed to take action. Action was taken. And part of the cost of that action is the fact that some of the dollars disappeared and they went where they weren't supposed to go. So you'll find people on both sides of that argument, because if you leave all the barriers in place, slows down the process, feeding our futures. Legitimately, students were told you can't go to school anymore. And guess what? That's where you got your lunch. You don't have access to lunch at home. So somebody needs to feed the kids who don't have access to meals. And this is a way that they were allowed to do that. You know, same thing with the Medicare program. 10% is fraud. We don't like that. Well, what if that enables our elderly people to actually be able to go to the doctor when they need to? And where are they going to go? You know, if we're limiting the funds or making it very hard to get to the funds. Again, we like to think maybe fraud shouldn't exist, but most people would say it's not realistic to build a system where fraud doesn't exist. The issue is putting the right amount of regulation and the right amount of barriers in place so that you can still do the good you need to do without being overrun by fraud.
We'll be right back in a minute.
Business world changes fast, and technology advances every single day. In these evolving fields, you need a skill set that not only keeps up with your career goals and busy life, but also gets you ahead. At St. Mary's University of Minnesota, our flexible programs can help you do just that. The School of Business and Technology offers bachelor's, degree completion, master's, and doctoral degrees for whatever career level and life stage you're in. Explore our programs in analytics, management, leadership, advanced technology, and more. At St. Mary's, you'll learn how to become a leader who ensures that business and tech are led with ethics and principles to ensure opportunities for all. Here, students learn to do good and lead great. Join us by visiting smumn.edu. St. Mary's University of Minnesota, because of you.
As you mentioned earlier, you worked as an auditor for Medicare, and you know, we're aware of how frequently that program is a target of fraudsters. What makes the public sector so susceptible to fraud compared to the private sector?
I think it's just, frankly, the size of the programs is, to some extent, very unwieldy. The programs, for better or worse, they're built to be very complex. You know, one thing to remember when we talk about fraud, to legally prove fraud, you have to prove intent. And this is one thing I learned working for the Medicare program is it's not a matter of, oh, I accidentally filled out this form correctly and put code 14642 when it was supposed to be 14648, right? It's that I purposely did it, right? It's one thing to make an error, and it's one thing to actually commit fraud and have the attempt. So I think, you know, the rules are just very complex. And the size of the programs is such that it's hard to make sure everything is in place where it needs to be. Also, historically, again, we don't really fund our regulating agencies to the extent that we could to eliminate fraud or even to limit it to a certain extent. You know, people get mad at big government and bureaucracy and all of those things, or you know someone who works for the government who doesn't work all that hard and still makes a decent salary, right? You get all fired up because those are taxpayer dollars. But again, there's a lot of good people working for the government protecting these programs, and they're asked to do a lot, and they run pretty lean. They honestly do, because again, having worked for the Medicare program, usually the dollars put into the program in terms of regulation, you know, you'll see different numbers, but they'll say, oh, if you put a dollar in, you're going to get eight back in terms of a return to the program. But regulation's not all that popular. You know, people who aren't breaking the rules don't feel like they should have to invest all that time in working with auditors or whatever agency is overseeing them. And, you know, people who are breaking the rules certainly don't want to see more dollars put into enforcement. So, you know, that's the trade-off.
Okay, wow. Yeah, that's fascinating. You mentioned recovery, you know, with cases of Medicare fraud or cases like Feeding Our Future. Who is mostly impacted by the fraud? And is there any sort of system to recover and help those people who have been impacted?
So, you know, we're all impacted because these are government dollars. Right.
Right.
So in the sense that they've stolen government funds and we're all taxpayers, we're all impacted. But again, there's 330 million of us. So to what extent was that in particular fraud affecting how much taxes I had to pay? Probably very little. Right. Really, you know, and this is also very hard to measure. The biggest group of people impacted are the people who, you know, may have received good services from the funds that were taken. And again, that's very hard to measure because even in the, you know, Feeding Our Futures case, meals were served. The prosecution isn't saying, hey, no meals were served. If factually speaking, meals were served, but not the number of meals that were claimed, right? So if, you know, Feeding Our Futures wasn't there and didn't commit this fraud, would there have been another law-abiding provider that would have stepped into that gap? You know, you like to think so, but you don't know because that's not how things played out. And it's the same with the Medicare program. You know, an elderly person goes and receives health care, or home health agency comes in and visits them because they need health care. And the provider files a claim for a trumped up disease. So we treated the person for X, Y, and Z. And really, it was only A, which is a much smaller ailment, right? So the provider will get overpaid, which is, you know, fraud and abuse of the system, but the elderly person still received health care. It's not right. I'm not advocating that it is right, but would a not fraudulent health care provider have picked up the gap there? Would that person had access to the health care that they did receive, albeit lesser health care than what was claimed to the government? You know, and these are all very tough questions to answer. If those dollars had not been taken by a fraudulent provider, would they have found their way to a more effective provider and done more good than they did? And that's a very hard question to answer.
So how can we enhance regulations? Oh, like you said, it seems like we will probably always be dealing with fraud, especially when it comes to government programs. But yeah, I mean, how do we enhance some of those regulations?
You know, the answer, I think, is, again, resources. So do we as a society invest in the protection or enforcement of all of the rules that do exist? Because we have a lot of rules. And, you know, the rules are made by our government, whom we elect, you know, Democrats and Republicans, and they don't always get along. They don't always see eye to eye. They're imperfect, but they exist, right? And the question is always about enforcement. I think maybe the more interesting question is, what level of enforcement or regulation are we satisfied? And I think zero is extraordinarily costly or probably not achievable. And, you know, back to the speed at which funds are and the amount of bureaucracy we want to deal with in our lives, how much regulation and oversight do we want by the government for all our programs? This is actually an interesting recent study, if you will. The Inflation Reduction Act gave a significant amount of funds to the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, to increase its enforcement of tax cheats. Well, historically, and they do surveys every year, did you cheat on your taxes? This is an anonymous survey, right? And did you cheat on your taxes? Well, historically, those percentages run anywhere from 16 to 19% of people who on these surveys, you know, say, yes, I knowingly cheated on my taxes in order to pay less taxes. So that's at least one in six of us. But there's still people who look at a survey like that and say, you know what, cheating on my taxes is breaking the law. I'm not actually going to check yes to this box. So probably the number is a bit higher than that. So I think realistically, if you're one of one in five people who knowingly cheats on their taxes, you know, are you in favor of 3,500 more IRS agents looking through your taxes every year? And the answer is probably not. Even if you're not a tax cheat, but audits tend to affect wealthy individuals. So if you're a wealthy American or a corporation, because that's another group that's going to get looked at, and you're not doing anything wrong, do you want to invest more of your time in dealing with an IRS auditor every year? Probably the answer is no, right? So we want to protect these funds, and we do. Again, like, I'm not saying we shouldn't be outraged when these cases come up, but I think we have to understand as a society, regulation isn't going to solve everything. I think there's a balance there. What we need to do, because we know regulation won't solve everything, you know, we need to train young people to be leaders. We need to train them to be ethical, moral, service-oriented, to look to strengthen, you know, the pillars of society that actually hold us together, rather than trying to enter into these systems for personal benefit, right? So regulation is good and has its place, but I think raising up ethical leaders is essential.
All right. Well, Derek, thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed having you on the show today.
I had a great time, Ben, and I really appreciate the program. So thanks for having me today.
St. Mary's Currents is a production of the St. Mary's University of Minnesota Office of Marketing and Communication. It is produced by Ben Rogers and Ashley Beeson. It is recorded, edited, and engineered by Jeffrey DeMarsh. Our theme music is by Will Vanda Cromer. I'm Ben Rogers. We'll see you next time for St. Mary's Currents.